We are, of course, looking at the Kings. In our study, we're in the period of time with the divided kings. And so in our last couple of studies, we looked at our last study at the kings, the quick succession there in the north. We've been in Israel for much of our study, the northern 10 tribes. And we were looking at Elah, Zimri, Tibni, and Omri. And this quick succession of four kings right there, back to back to back, and kind of what was going on with them, and how the sin of these kings really has led to a lot of turmoil with that. And we move from there into Ahab. Now, Ahab, a lot of people will know that name, at least be somewhat familiar with Ahab in Israel, because he was such a bad king and did so many evil things. And so we were looking at him, and we're going to continue forward. There's a lot here with Ahab. Now, some kings, again, I'll mention, we're not going to spend a lot of time on, but Ahab, there's just so much there. And I find it interesting. Ahab may be one of the kings you find the most about, with the exception of Saul and David and Solomon. And so we're going to continue with that. If we have time, we're moving forward to, we'll begin to look at Jehoshaphat in the south, and we'll move back to Judah. And so tonight, as we begin, we're looking at Ahab. Now, Ahab reigned 875 to about 854, so he's got about 20-year reign there in the north. Of course, who is the wife of Ahab? We're all most people are familiar with his wife, Jezebel, right? And so, of course, she factors in a lot in his reign. Now, when we were together last week, we began to look at an overview. As you're in chapter 16, there, as the writer is recording the life of Ahab, he gives us a kind of a summary of his life. And so in verse 29, he tells us that Ahab reigned over Israel and Samaria 22 years. Now, what's significant about Samaria? Becomes the capital of the north. We noted, and here it is on the map, we noted the capital has kind of moved around a little bit. Well, now it's going to really kind of find a home in Samaria. This is also significant because when you get to the New Testament, Samaria kind of becomes synonymous with the Israel, the people of the northern kingdom of Israel. John 4, of course, is where Jesus meets the Samaritan woman at the well. You know, she's from Samaria, important place. Verse 34 of this same text lets us know something. Verse 30, before I get to 34. Verse 30 said that we have read over and over again where the text will describe these kings as being more evil than their predecessors, or it will define them as being like Jeroboam. Remember Jeroboam? What did he do? Just as a way of a reminder, what was his big sins? All right, so number one, he put an idol, a calf, a golden calf in Bethel and all the way up here in Dan. So number one, he led the people in idolatry. What else did he do?
Had priests that were not Levites.
Yes, were anyone but Levites, which went even beyond that. He, of course, brought in a lot of idolatry. So you remember those two big things about Jeroboam. Now, when you get to Ahab, you find this descriptor in verse 30 that he did more in regard to evil than all who were before him. So it's this intensifying sinful condition. It's just getting worse. And he has intensified it greatly. Verse 31 lets us know that he married Jezebel. Now, what do we know about Jezebel from verse 31? Is she an Israelite? She's a Sidonian, right? She's a foreign lady, and he has married her. Of course, the Bible, and we looked at this, condemns that practice of the Israelites going after foreign women. What else do you note from verse 31? 16:31. Yeah, and it seems to indicate that she was a driving force of that, of bringing in this idolatrous worship. Now, it's interesting, as we move forward, you'll see how like she is just emotionally attached to this form of idolatry, especially when we get into Elijah.
Mm-hmm. Ahab does a lot of listening to what.
And yeah, that's where we're going to go in this, yeah.
Whatever she wants, she mm-hmm. gets.
Yeah. Especially when we get into chapter, is it 19, I believe. We'll note that, or 20, chapter 20. But yeah, keep that in mind. We looked at Exodus 34 and Deuteronomy. Let's go on to... in looking at this overview of his life. Let's go to verse 32. It says, he erected an altar for Baal in the house of Baal. So he built, if you will, a temple akin to that of God's temple in Jerusalem, to the temple of Israel. He has his own house with his own altar there. It says, verse 32, built it in Samaria, and Ahab made Asherah. Now, Baal is one idol. Asherah is a different idol. So it's not like it's just one form of idolatry. They have lots of forms of idolatry. They also have the high places. They have the Ashtaroth, right? And so they have all these idolatrous practices. Ahab, he goes on to describe him. Ahab did more to provoke the Lord, the God of Israel, to anger than all the kings who were before him. And so he's really driving home this idea of just how evil Ahab was. And so with a force, he says Ahab's worse than all of them. Even Jeroboam is beneath Ahab in his evil. And then in verse 34, it says that he built Jericho. He laid its foundation. Okay, so before I finish this, I want you to go back. So, Jericho, what do we know about Jericho? Where do you first find or read about Jericho?
First city the Jews came to when they crossed into the promised land.
Okay, so it's that first city. What else do you know about Jericho from the Bible? What was going on there? Yes, ma'am. So they had these huge walls. They actually had double layer walls when you look at the city construction. They had an outer wall and an inner wall. They were very thick. I don't remember the dimensions. I just remember they're really huge. And this is also where we read about Rahab and her conversion to Judaism. And it's here where Achan sinned. Right, and it would lead to their defeated Ai. So Jericho, very important. It was that first place that they arrived at after crossing the Jordan. Now, if you go back to Joshua 6, after the defeat of Jericho. What does verse 26 say? Somebody read that. Joshua 6, verse 26.
First be the man before the Lord that raises up and builds this city, Jericho. He shall lay the foundation thereof in his firstborn, and in his youngest son shall he set up the gates thereof.
All right, so they've defeated Jericho. They marched for 6 days one time. The seventh day they walked seven times. On the seventh, at the completion of the seventh time around, they yell, scream, blow the trumpets. The walls fall down. They walk in, they get this easy victory. And then following the victory, Joshua lays an oath or a curse upon Jericho. And it's a significant one. What was his oath? So his oath was that Jericho would not be built again. And if you did, what would happen? You'd lose your oldest and your youngest. And so this is a pretty powerful oath. Now, the Israelites obviously should have known this oath. Ahab has no excuse for not knowing it. But you see what he did. Despite that, maybe thinking God didn't really mean it. Maybe God's prophet Joshua didn't really mean it. It says, though, verse 34, he laid its foundation at the cost of Abram, his firstborn, and set up its gate at the cost of his youngest son, Segub. All right, and so he loses both children because of this sin he committed. And so you see, maybe you begin to get a picture of some of what he did to elicit from God description of being worse than all before him. This is just a couple of the things he did. We're going to talk about some more. But there were a lot of things he did. These are a few. All right. Do you have some?
Well, according to what I understand, it wasn't Ahab that rebuilt the city. It was Heal. I assume it's because it says Heal of Bethlehem.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're right. I messed that up. Okay. Thank you for correcting me on that. Yes, it was Heal that built it, and it was Heal that lost his two sons. Thank you for correcting me on that. So Heal, during the time of Ahab, rebuilt the city of Jericho. Thank you. So a lot of things going on there in the north to kind of bring God's ire against him. So apologize for that. I should have read that more closely. So you have all this going on. You have the condition, the spiritual condition being really bad in the north. Well, you have a man named Elijah. And we're introduced to him along with the telling of the life of Ahab. And so they're very closely connected. Ahab, Jezebel, Elijah, and Elisha. They're all interconnected. And we're going to see how. Hopefully as we move forward. So we're introduced to Elijah in 1 Kings 17. So chapter 17 opens up by introducing to us Elijah the Tishbite of Tishbe in Gilead. And so, if I can remember. So you see the water source here. Tishbe was a town right on the brook Cherethith. And it's settled right there on the river. That's where he's from. God calls him into service, verse 1. I don't know, I may have that on the map on here too, just so you see it. So, a little bit smaller here, but there's Tishbe, and it's right on that brook right there. So, God calls him, verse 1. As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, before whom I stand, there shall be neither dew nor rain these days except by my word. So the first thing we have recorded that Elijah did was he called for a drought on the land. And it's interesting, go to the book of James. James, in discussing faith, will use Elijah and what he did here as an example of faith and the type of faith you and I ought to have. He calls for this drought. Verse 2, it says, the word of the Lord came to him. So he's called this drought. The word of the Lord comes to him. And he says, depart from here and turn eastward and hide yourself by the brook Kereth, which he would have known very well, which is east of the Jordan. You shall drink from the brook, and I've commanded that the ravens to feed you there. So he leads a very interesting life, and a lot of interesting things happens to him. Here's one of the things that is noted in the text, that God will often uses different means to give him protection and to supply his needs. Here you have ravens being God's providential hand, bringing food to Elijah. That fascinates me. Ravens are very smart. And it's interesting, ravens are noted as being thieves. I don't know if you know this, but ravens, some people train them to steal. And ravens will actually trade you things. Will trade for food with you. People have been noted doing this. Well, here God using the raven to feed Elijah. God tells him to wait there, and the ravens do that. As you continue reading down through verse 7, he's there, and he is being fed by the ravens and by the given water by the brook. So, but what did he pray for at the beginning of that? Rain. So he says it's going to rain. Now, what happens when it stops raining? What happens when we have a drought? Things begin to dry. Rivers dry up. The land gets harder, right? What's eventually going to happen to this brook? Right? It's going to eventually stop giving water. And so, so Elijah stays there for a while. Eventually, the brook begins to dry up. Then God sends him away. He says in verse 9 that he's to go to Zarephath, which belongs to Sidon, and he's to dwell there with a widow. And this widow is going to take care of him. Now, up here, whoops, I didn't mean to do that. So you'll see it up here on this map. It's up here on the coast between Sidon and Tyre. It's in Phoenicia. Here on the map, it doesn't actually have it, but it would be about right here. So he's up above where the northern kingdom is. Now remember, he's from Tishbe, and now he's living up here. And he's going to come into the home of this widow. And again, God's going to find an interesting way to take care of his needs. And so he goes there, he finds this widow. Now in verse 10, it says that when he gets to Zarephath, he comes to the gate of the city, and there's a widow who was gathering sticks. He called to her and said, bring me a little water in a vessel that I may drink. Verse 11, and as she was going to bring it, he called to her and said, bring me a morsel of bread in your hand. Simple request, but what's her response in verse 12? And she doesn't have bread. She has very little bread. And she, you notice here, she says, only a handful of flour in a jar and a little oil in a jug. And now I'm gathering a couple sticks that I may go in and prepare it for myself and my son, that we may eat it and die. Now, why does she think she's going to die?
No food.
Why does she have any food? Drought, right? What does drought affect? Is it going to affect the wheat? Going to affect the wheat. Not a lot of flour to go around. When you have scarcity of product, well, those who have the most money can buy it. This is a poor widow. She's not going to be able to buy the expensive wheat on the market. And so she has a little bit. Her and her son are there living together. And she's like, this is it. You know, she doesn't know where her next meal is coming from. What I also find interesting, it doesn't tell us one way or another, even if she's Jew, if she's a Jewish woman. I think it's reasonable to assume she's not Jewish. She's a Gentile. She lives in the Gentile world. There seems to be no indication. Now, I can't say that for sure one way or the other. But so she has little means. She's there picking up sticks so she can go in and bake this loaf of bread, the last that she has. And so he asks this of her. Verse 13, he says to her, "Do not fear. Go and do as you have said. First, make me a little cake of it and bring it to me, and afterward, make something for yourself and your son. For thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, the jar of flour shall not be spent, and the jug of oil shall not be empty until the day the Lord sends rain upon the earth." So remember, the drought is the problem, most likely. And rain would be good, but who knows when that's coming. Now, what is Elijah asking of this woman? Whether she's an Israelite or not, he's asking her for faith. Believe in me. What proof does she have to have faith in him? She does later, but so far, what proof? It's interesting. She just kind of, what you'll see is she just accepts it. She trusts, and she does it. But he's asking her, have faith in me. Now, it'd be a pretty neat thing to know you can keep going back to the same well and keep drawing out good water, right? And what we say is we can't expect to just keep going back to the well and drawing out water. That water has to eventually be replenished. Well, he's saying, you don't have to worry about that. So he's taking away this huge worry off her shoulders if it's true. But he's asking her to step out on faith. And this is even a greater leap in my mind if she's not an Israelite. She doesn't even have that connection if she is a Gentile with the God of Israel. Now, if she is, at least she'd have some association with that. So, yes, ma'am. And that's possible, but again, think about, all right, she is a long way away from where he grew up. Now, it's possible. I read it, I don't get that indication from her. But that's just me. I don't know. It could be. But, I mean, if you think about, you know, how many people do we know that far away, just in general? Oh, are you talking about God or Elijah?
Yeah, I'm just saying that, you know, like, word gets around. You know,
yeah.
Whether she knew him or not, she might have heard of him.
Yeah, and that's...
something about him is what I'm saying. Maybe he wasn't a complete stranger. I mean, he's done other miracles. I mean, or he's prophesied. He's a prophet. He's been around. You know what I mean? I don't know. I'm just trying to figure out why she would completely trust us. Somebody she knew nothing about with food that would take out of the mouth of her child with no knowledge of him at all.
Yeah, and so, yeah, that's a possibility. The other possibility is she has nowhere else to turn. If he's right, then she has, you know, then she can feed her child for a longer period of time.
But did he tell her that? Or he, I don't remember him saying that he said, feed me. He didn't say, and then you'll just keep getting stuff.
Well, you go down to verse 14 right after he says that. He says, for thus says the Lord God of Israel, the jar of flour shall not be spent, and the jug of oil shall not be empty until the day that the Lord sends rain upon the earth. So he gives her that promise. So whether she did it believing in that, or if she did it just out of simple kindness of her heart, here's this guy, he's obviously famished and hungry, and she has a little bit, so she's going to share with him. Whatever the motivation is, it could be lots of different things, but yeah, she it's kind of an amazing act of faith on her part, in my mind.
You know, verse 9 says that the Lord commanded the widow to provide for you.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't know what that consisted of.
Yeah, and there's another element to there that God doesn't lay out for us how he influenced her to do this. I don't know. Yeah. That's a lot of unanswered questions.
Elijah, and his very personal character, sometimes people can evoke a lot of confidence just by the way they carry themselves and how he viewed the situation.
Yeah.
It seems like Jesus mentioned in back in his life that God didn't send Elijah to anybody but the widow in the days of the famine, and our Naaman, the leper, Israel was cured of leprosy except Naaman. No one was given rations, but I think it goes to the fact that she probably was not a Jew.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, you know, whatever the situation is, we know God didn't make her do it. God doesn't take away our free will. She still had to act out of faith, you know, in some element here. And so he says that to her, and at verse 17, the mistress of the house became, verse 15. Sorry, I'm jumping ahead of myself. 15. She went out and did as Elijah said, and she and he and her household ate for many days. God did exactly what Elijah said he would do. The jar of flour was not spent, neither the jug of oil become empty, according to the word of the Lord that he spoke through Elijah. Now, this is one powerful example of God being with Elijah and reaffirming this woman's faith in Elijah and in God ultimately. You're going to have another one. You're going down to verse 17. The son of this woman, her only kind of family, it seems to be, in the world, it's her and him, and he becomes ill. The text tells us his illness was so severe that there was no breath left in him, indicating he's died. He's gone. There's a lot of different events where someone's raised from the dead. This is one of those. It's interesting. Elisha will have a very similar resurrection that he'll perform as well. But here is the son. He's there, no breath left in him. And she, you know, sometimes when we hurt, what do? We lash out. Right? And she lashes out. And she says, "What have you against me, O man of God? You've come to me to bring my sin to remembrance and to cause the death of my son." And so she's distressed, and we can all understand that. She's, you know, she's in deep sorrow. And Elijah says to her in verse 19, give me your son. He then takes him in his arms, he took him from her arms. He carried him up into the upper chamber where he lodged and laid him on his own bed. And then Elijah cries out to the Lord, "O Lord, my God, why have you brought calamity even upon the widow with whom I sojourn by killing her son?" Then he stretched himself out upon the child three times and cried to the Lord, "O Lord, my God, let this child's life come into him again." And the Lord listened to the voice of Elijah and the life of the child came into him again, and he revived. Now, as you might imagine, this is an unbelievable action. This just doesn't happen. People are not resurrected on a normal basis. It's a very rare thing, and it's always when God is acting. And of course, this is going to cause a great stir in this woman's life. It's going to cause a great stir in that community. You know, people are going to find out about it. But why is God doing this? I mean, there are a lot of people who die all the time. There are a lot of parents who lose children all the time. During that time, it was no different. There was a famine going around. There was a drought. Why does God do this particular resurrection?
Because he sees she's so low on faith.
Is it really, ask this the right way, is it really about her and that boy, or is it about something else? I think it really is about Elijah, because God's going to ask some hard things of Elijah. He already has. I mean, think about it. One time he's being fed by ravens. Now that sounds all kind of like sci-fi and like you might read that in a book or something. But to be in a condition where you're having to be fed by ravens, that's a pretty low spot. Where you're having to run from one place to the other. He's not living a glamorous life. He had to go, and he's having to rely on this widow. I mean, how hard is it to ask help from people? Do we ever have problems asking for help? Sure. How hard is it to ask help from a poor person? Wouldn't that be much harder? If I knew they're struggling and I'm going to ask help from them, that'd be a hard thing to do. That's what God's asking Elijah to do, isn't it? Here's one person asking, one poor person asking another poor person, help me out.
Well, that's what I was going to say. At that time, he was as poor as she was.
Yeah. He doesn't have anything.
It didn't make it any easier. But it also proved to her who he was and who mm-hmm. God was.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Because she says a couple verses, now I know about your God.
And I would be fascinated to hear the rest of her life. Now, we only hear this, as far as I know. We're never told about what happened to her after this. But that's why I think this is really about Elijah, and it's about God preparing him. Look, Elijah, I can do great things through you. Just trust me. Look at what you did. Look at what you've already done. No.
But children and adults, anybody, possesses this time and chance happens to us all. Mm-hmm. You die, and this child died a natural process. They really are charging God as being the culprit, when God wasn't.
No, God, no, but he providentially put Elijah there.
Mm-hmm. And give him back his life.
Yeah.
To me, he still didn't get his then either. Because after the miracle, and I don't want to go too far ahead, but when he set the water around the trenches,
yeah,
set it on fire, and him to still be, to have experienced God on
such a level as he had, and still to run after all of those countless things that God has done, he still did.
Yeah, so let's go there. That's where we're going to go next. Let's go to chapter 18. So I think 17 sets Elijah up to be able to do what he's going to do in 18. What he does in 18, before we jump ahead to the cave, all right, let's go to the mountaintop. Let's go to the mountaintop before we get to the cave. But I think it's easy sometimes for us to look at history and say, well, I would have done better, right? But it's a very arrogant thing for us to think. If I was in his shoes, could I have stood up against 400 prophets of Baal? Plus all the other prophets. It's not just 400 of Baal. We often key on that. But there's another 400, 450 of Astra. I think it's Astra. We'll get there. That he's going up against. So let's go to chapter 18. So God says in chapter 18, he says in verse 1, go show yourself to Ahab. So God has prepared Elijah. Now you're ready. You need to go to Ahab. Now, Ahab like Elijah? No. No. Notice the conversation they have when we get there, but just keep that in mind. He says, go, and I will send rain upon the earth. So we're in the midst of this drought. God's getting ready to perform this really great thing on Mount Carmel, and then he's going to return the rain to the land. All right, so he says, I will send rain upon the earth, verse 2. So Elijah went to show himself to Ahab. Now the famine was severe in Samaria. So again, you note that Samaria, the capital of the northern kingdom, they are really suffering here. Here on this map, Samaria, about right in the middle of the large part of the body of the country. There's Samaria. There's where King Ahab is. We're also introduced in this section to another prophet of God, Obadiah. You'll note that he's one of the writers. He has one of the smallest books in the Old Testament. I think it's like 10 verses long. Ahab and Obadiah are going to go out, and they are going to, it says in verse 3, Ahab called Obadiah, who was over the household, and it notes something about Obadiah, that he feared the Lord greatly. So this is a man of God, living in a very difficult time to be a man of God, by the way. He's really facing a culture that's against him. And it says, and when Jezebel cut off the prophets of the Lord, Obadiah took 100 prophets and hid them by 50s in a cave and fed them with bread and water. So there's a lot that we're not told that was going on. One of those things was Jezebel was on a crusade to destroy the prophets of God. And she was having them murdered. But Obadiah, a man of God, was trying to protect those prophets. Verse 7 says that that they're out in the country, and Elijah meets Obadiah. And it's obvious that Obadiah knows Elijah. He recognizes him. And then Elijah says, go tell Ahab I'm here, right? Bring him to me. Now, one of the interesting things is when you read the text there, is it makes it quite obvious Ahab does not like Elijah. He's trying to capture him and to kill him. And it went so far, his hatred of Elijah was so strong that there have been people who've said they saw Elijah, and when they got there and Elijah wasn't there, he killed the guy that said that. His anger is so strong. Now, again, remember what God did with Elijah with the widow. Think about what Elijah's doing. Could you do that? Could I do that? Could I go face a king I know that had the power and the motivation to murder me? I mean, this is a big deal. And so the text goes on there. Obadiah, he eventually goes to get Ahab. Verse 16, Ahab comes to meet Elijah. Now notice verse 17. When Ahab saw Elijah, Ahab said to him, "Oh, is it you, you troubler of Israel?" Now what he really means, is it you, my thorn in the flesh? I think there's a parallel between John the Baptist and King Herod. They had the similar relationship. Remember, it was John the Baptist, John the Immerser in the New Testament, who was telling Herod, you don't have any right to be with his brother's wife. And that eventually ends up getting John's head cut off. So you've got this real tension. He's like, you know, you troubler of Israel. You notice Elijah's response. You just standing there, and this powerful man with all the vitriol and hatred that he can muster says to you, you troubler. I mean, would your toes be a little sweaty? You ever get nervous and your feet get sweaty? I think Elijah's feet are a little sweaty. You know, to have the gumption and the courage to do this, men like that, men like John the Immerser, men like Elijah who stand up in the midst of real hatred. I mean, that's a powerful example. And so Elijah says, "I have not troubled Israel, but you have." You know, he calls him out to his face. You know, you think about Nathan in 2 Samuel 12. He has this same duty, but it's to David. Now, David could have killed him too. It took a lot of courage for Nathan to stand up to David and say, "You're the man." But here is an evil king who has killed people, lots of them, just because he didn't like them. And so I'll end on this. He says, "I have not troubled Israel, but you have for your father's house and your father's house because you have abandoned the commandments of the Lord and followed the Baals. Now therefore, send and gather all Israel to me at Mount Carmel and the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table." And that's where we'll pick up next week. Go ahead and read 18 to the end of the book here. We're going to keep moving through this these series of chapters about Ahab, and we'll move on into Jehoshaphat and look at his life as well. Thank you so much. We'll be dismissed and reassemble in just a minute for our devotional time. Thank you.